Hello, and welcome to the No Good Poetry Podcast. Each week we talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of poetry.
This is episode 2.
With
Joseph Bienvenue and
Joseph Makos.
This is the good, bad, and the ugly, isn't it? Some ugly shit out there, kids. Let's make the world safer for poetry.
So, talking about the election and all of that.
Here we are.
The election happened. And, you know, my creative writing class met the day after the election. And I'm like, oh, what? You know, it's like, I can't just go to my normal workshop today.
Sure not, no.
After the day of the election. So I'm thinking, like, what am I going to do? So I was thinking about it, and it made me think of Jack Spicer.
Sure.
And, it made me think about what it, like, kind of what you had brought up in this post. Like, what is politics' place in poetry, and what do we do with this? So I gave them this little excerpt just to think about. I'm not going to read the little introductory thing. But I pulled out some quotes from, you know, like, near the end of Spicer's life. He gave those lectures in Berkeley. I don't know if you remember about that. But gave all those lectures in Berkeley. And one of them was on politics and poetry. And this was in 1965.
Whoa.
So this is like the height of the Vietnam War.
Sure.
Yes, right. So that's very much on everyone's mind, and they're asking about these things. And I don't know if you remember, like, Spicer's kind of interesting with his relation to politics. I guess that was kind of a big thing that he refused to sign the loyalty oath.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like when that was going on. But I don't know that he was doing that necessarily as a political move, other than he just thought, this is bullshit.
Yeah, I'm not going to sign anything that I don't recognize in the first place. Seems like a Spicer move.
Yeah. But then he was involved in that early gay rights movement, that Mattachine protest movement. So, I mean, I think he had some experience in how protests worked and what he thought of it. So this is interesting because this was later in his life after he had kind of gotten to... I mean, I don't know. He didn't live to be that old, but I mean, he didn't know he was going to be dying not long after this, but he was, right? This part was kind of in an interview format, and I thought it was interesting.
So what does he say?
So he's, I mean, I don't know, I don't remember where this is, but this is the first part I got from him. He said, the point is that essentially the enemy, as I think I quoted in one poem from Rosa Luxemburg, is in your own country. I mean, you're not going to be able to do a good goddamn thing about Vietnam. That's absolutely out, because President Johnson's not terribly interested in whether intellectuals don't like Vietnam or not. As a matter of fact, I imagine he thinks whenever an intellectual says something about Vietnam, that it's a very good thing for him. And then, parentheses, laughter, because the whole room laughed at that.
Sure.
Right? And I think that's very true, right? Especially when you're talking about intellectuals. And that makes the poetry thing even more crazy, right? Like any president, they're going to spin that in their direction, if anything. Like, oh, these elites.
Sure.
Talking about... like, all right, cool. So he says that. And they laugh. And he says, no, I mean, seriously, just that. Seriously, there's no possible way of getting at anything about the American system that I've been able to figure out in 40 years. Maybe you people can. It'd be marvelous if you could, but I don't think so. The point is, then, if you're poets, not too many flashbulbs, huh? You ought to figure out what the power system is within your own community. Your enemy is simply something which is going to try to stop you from writing poetry.
Ah, bam. There it is. He hits it.
Yeah.
He hits it right on the head. So basically... this is an exploration of the individual as the vessel for the language, right? So if it stops you from writing poetry, which you gotta be careful because some of your own poetry can stop you from writing poetry, or other people's poetry can stop you writing for poetry. So, okay, so now he's taught, and so basically what he addresses is that
But that's the problem, right? And that's the problem I had with the poem we read. If you're saying, you're an armchair poet, why aren't you writing about the things that are relevant? You're stopping people from writing poetry. You're saying, this is what you should be writing about.
Sure.
And it's not relevant if you're not.
Right, which is what I mean, it goes, that's an address of the Academy. I think that's what's happening in that poem here.
Maybe, but it's an address of poetry in general. In general. On top of that, you know? And I don't know if that's fair. I don't think that what that poem is doing is any more relevant than what other people are doing, right? I gotta read some more. This is such a good
lecture. Spicer goes on here, right?
This is such a good lecture.
He goes on and on.
When I get upset by reading about Vietnam and what we're going to do there and so forth and so on, it hurts me as a poet. And I'm trying to think of the right words for this. There's a poet who's writing poetry, who is a conveyor of poetry, that doesn't have anything to do with his poems if he's a good poet.
That's Ooh.
And I was like, he's got that idea, right? It's coming from somewhere else. It's not you anyway.
You're the vessel.
You're a conduit, right?
You're a conduit
for that thing. Which, I mean, that's a Spicer thing, but I totally agree with him with that. Okay, so it doesn't have anything to do with his poems if he's a good poet. There's the individual, and then there's the society he moves in. Mao Tse once said, you swim in it like a fish. You swim in whatever circumstance you are in. He's talking about guerrilla war at the time. You swim in it like a fish, but it's pretty difficult to do. These people, these Johnsons or these Olsons or these Kennedys or these anythings, they're better than you are at it. What you have to do is somehow or other figure out some way to swim in the thing like a fish but not sell out. And I don't know how you do that. I really don't.
Damn. Yeah, you know, he's addressing this, you know, wow. So he says this in what, 65?
1965.
So, you know, this is not where we're at now. This is absolutely not where we're at now, because I think the poetry world has been completely consumed by the lack of the poet being unaware of the poet. Seems as though the poet is like what it is now. Like, I am the poet.
But that's a huge mistake, I think. I mean, I don't know. Like, I still read this and I'm like, man, Jack, you understand it, right? Like, you can't. And, like, that's the problem. And that's the thing.
He quotes Mao.
Well, yeah. Well, that's a little weird. I don't know, but that's a good quote.
In 1965, that was a thing to do, right?
Well, yeah, I guess. And, I mean, you are talking about guerrilla warfare. Maybe poetry, if you're going to be political, maybe political poetry has to be guerrilla warfare. You better not see it coming.
Well, the student uprising in Paris was fresh on the mind. Or no, it didn't happen yet. It was 67, I think? Or 68?
I mean, look. That's the problem with all these poems we read. They're overtly, here's my political poem that I'm going to tell you.
Sure, here is my...
Like, that'd be like if you were trying to conduct guerrilla warfare and you're like, I am coming out of the jungle now.
Yeah, here I am, putting on my guerrilla warfare outfit. Here I am, putting on my...
Like, if you want to have any kind of effective political poetry, I think he's right. Like, you've got to be inside of the society... And any poetry, I mean, that's the important part, right? Like, it's gotta be subversive on some way. Like, you can't just face things head on. This is not a...
Right. Which brings me back to the beginning, which is, and again, I've come back to this, boomeranged back to this several times now, but it is about the co-opting if we don't control the language that we use, and we don't actually understand how language is being used in advertising, in all sorts of different ways, you know, and like we need to look at like the way it's being used in pop culture and advertising and in magazines and on television and in Facebook, and you know, that's the thing, is like language has become money, you know, the ads have become money, the things on the side of the page have become money, the things on the bottom of the page have become money, and I think, you know, it's like maybe it's time to go back into those things, you know?
Well, it's interesting, and I think you're right. Like, a lot of contemporary poetry, I think, is trying to reclaim those things, right? But I don't know that that's effective. I think I totally understand what you're saying, but they're saying instead of us fighting that, we're going to try and reclaim the social media. We're going to try to reclaim the money aspect of that. We're going to try and, like, take that as our own and use it for our own purposes. But I think that's very dangerous because you think you're doing it for your own purposes, but it's still getting co-opted into this other thing.
Because you're still
wanted to or not,
right? Right. Right. So it has a foothold.
And you're right. I think that's part of it about the language. Like, that's very hard to fight.
Very difficult. Very challenging to break through that. I mean, the only thing you can do is, you know, reinvent your own language or take things... Ooh, this one hurts. This one hurts.
I think, unfortunately, which is extremely difficult, and I almost can't ask any writer to do this, you need to be so intensely aware of the connotation of every single phrase that you're using.
Sure.
Because if you're not, like, what? Oh, I'm accidentally referencing this reality TV show, or I'm accidentally referencing some meme on the internet, and that totally changes the purpose of what you're trying to say.
Because you're putting it in that...
Well, you might not intend to, but that's still where it is, because the people who are reading it, that's where it is.
A world that exists where the podcasters will say, and now a poem from our sponsors, right? I mean, isn't that the goal? Wouldn't that be the goal? Is like, and now a poem from our sponsors.
Well, and maybe there's some way to do that where that'd be okay, but I don't know. And it's a tricky situation to try to do that, right? And it's a hard thing. Can you do that and ever divorce yourself from these things? And then if you're trying to make an actual change in the political policy of the world, that's even more complicated.
I once thought about you know, the idea of writing through a book. I once thought about writing through the Patriot Act, and I started. It was impossible.
So you might want to explain that, because I don't think everyone's going to know what you mean.
Oh, the idea of writing through. You know, the idea of we print out this 100-and-some-page document. You know, that was just ramrodded through. You know, Congress. You know, and we go through it, and we do an eraser or some sort of, you know, process in which we would. You know, and it might take you one of those. It might be one of those things where you read the first 20 pages and you got to start again.
Would be, exactly,
right? Has someone done that? I'm curious. You know, should we look that up? And it's like maybe the Patriot Act doesn't have as much gravitas.
Well, I think
as
you could do it,
other documents do
think,
these days.
I think it's complicated. I think I've seen people do things like that. But the problem is, again, we're talking about political poetry. A lot of times when people try to do that with a document like that, they get really ham-fisted with
the language.
The language, right? Where I think if you were going to do that, the fun thing to do with it would be to not worry about any of the implications about it whatsoever. Just get lost in the language that's actually there and leaving things and seeing what...
If
it doesn't come out funny, you're doing it wrong, right?
The rhyme, the happy circumstances, the sort of, you know, flarf aspects of it.
Well,
the kind of things that just...
I don't know if I want to use the flarf term, but yeah, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, okay, let's forgive us, Father, for we have sinned. But the sort of like... The document itself.
The true...
Examining the...
Yeah, the true, like...
Like, finding the poetry behind the Patriot Act.
Yeah, which is there. It's pretty hidden,
but it's probably there, incorporating the language...
And what would that do? In a way, I mean, maybe that's the best thing. Because what would it do? It would be like, even this horrible offspring of ideology and poor planning. And I don't think anyone liked the Patriot Act. I don't think even the people who passed it really liked it. It was just this political convenience in a lot of ways, right? But even that has some beauty behind it. Even that has some hidden thing inside of it, which I think you're right. That would be enough. That'd be far more worthwhile than trying to turn it into some heavy-handed political comment.
But if you don't know, you don't know. I mean, the thing is that, you know, I don't think that the poets of today are as read up on the political climate as maybe were the poets during World War One. Absolutely not.
I think you're probably right.
Absolutely not. That, yeah. Absolutely not.
All right, I got a little more Spicer, though.
Okay, bring Spicer back. Let's talk about
it. So now the questioner comes back in, and he says, Do you want to be the questioner? Do you want to read the questioner?
What's the question?
Here's the questioner.
Sure, the questioner is asking Spicer here. Did you also mean that if a poet should become vitriolic or very much against a political objective, that he would also damage his other poetry? In other words, does he have an obligation to perhaps speak up against political acts that he doesn't agree with, if no more than anything else, to get it off his chest?
All right.
That's a good question.
That's a good question. And then our boy says, yeah, except it doesn't work that way. Of all the poems I've seen in the last 10 years coming from this area, I haven't seen one good political poem. And I think that's sort of an answer to you.
Whoa. So Spicer is saying from Berkeley in 1965 that for 10 years for 10 years he hasn't seen one good political poem.
And then the questioner says,
would you recommend that he write it and throw it away?
Yeah, he says, would you recommend that he write it and throw it away? And Spicer says, yeah. Or write a letter to his congressman or something like that. It's just as meaningless. I mean, I bet that at least 95% of you are against the Vietnam thing. Okay, so what do? You write a letter to your congressman. You write it down in poetry. But it doesn't come out right then. Again, I don't know of any political poems which have worked. Uh-huh. Now you pick at the Oakland Tribune and what happens? And then the questioner says...
The questioner comes back and says, wait and see. Spicer says,
well, not really wait and see, because the thing is not that simple. You know damn well the Oakland Tribune's going to have its same subscribers it had before. You know damn well that the hiring practices, if they're changed, will be changed by hiring one or two Negroes, and that's it. You don't know anything else about it. If you wanted to bomb the Oakland Tribune building like they bombed the LA Times building in 1912, something like that, then that would make some sense.
Damn, okay, so Spicer's calling for... Is he calling... Well, he didn't quite call for...
Well, but he's saying...
A bombing.
If that's what you're trying to do, though, he's saying, like, that would be...
When... This is 65?
This is 1965.
Should you quickly Google when the Weather Underground bombed the ferry building?
That's a good question.
Because that's... Because I think the Weather Underground bombed the ferry building, perhaps...
It was in this era.
Like 60s. It might have been, maybe... And then then when they break Larry out of jail and...
I think it's a little later, but...
Hit him in Sausalito?
It's around this time, man. All right, we're going to find that out. But then what is the question?
Perhaps the significance of FSM was to return the university to the students and teachers rather than keeping it in the hands of the administrators.
All right, so they're talking about that whole... I mean, that's... Well, again... I'm talking now as a person in society, not as a poet. And we've been getting off poetry and onto society, which I suppose is reasonable. But look, what's going to happen with the university, which is expanding too fast, which is going to have administrators who have to be experts in all of that? It's like trying to go against computers or something. The university wasn't returned to the teachers or the students, which it never did belong to. It was simply made quiescent with a nice tranquilizing thing. And you got rid of a man who was going to be fired anyway. Strong. And what else happened?
Questioner comes back and says, well, you're right. We're getting a little off track here. And the problem, I think, is that we're all part of the same imaginative force, meaning the poets, the university, the politics involved. How do you separate any part of it? Spicer comes back and says,
it's damn difficult. And they laugh at him.
Yeah.
Now, I mean that seriously. It's damn difficult. And trying to separate it, I'm simply trying to tell you, number one, don't sell out as a poet. Number two, just remain cool about the rest of the things, because you're not going to be able to do anything about it anyway.
Ouch.
All right.
Okay. No, well, they clearly don't laugh at that one, right?
No, they don't. They take a...
And yet you say that no political poetry you know of has ever been successful, and it seems Auden says that the same thing about Yeats. The businessman roaring in the bourse, and poetry makes nothing happen. But is that inevitably so, and what can you say about it?
And Spicer says, well... Number one, I think that if we were all able, which I'm not and no one I've seen has been, to remain firm and dedicated, and at the same time know where we're going, not trying to buck the University of California, which is just not buckable, but know where we're going. It's possible, yes. It hasn't happened, and I would still like anyone in the audience to tell me about one poem which changed anything in history. And then the questioner gives a poem that he thinks.
But didn't you say that 1919 was a good political poem?
Spicer says, oh, it's a lovely poem, but it's not a political poem. It's a poem of despair. I mean, my God, the weasel's tooth? No, what Yeats is talking about in the poem much better than I'm talking about is exactly the same thing. There's no real way that I can see to do it. If there were, I'd do it in a moment.
So, Spicer's a little bit of a fatalist.
But it's not Spicer. But not really. It's not just Spicer. I think that's, like, where you have to be as a poet, right? And, like the questioner said, like, Auden said the same thing about Yeats. Yeah, Yeats is great, but Auden called him the businessman roaring in the bourse.
Right.
Like, man, you can write about political stuff all you want. It's not going to do shit. And, like, are you losing yourself as a poet while you're doing that?
Right. Well, he says at the beginning, he says the thing that your enemy is the thing that's preventing you from writing poetry. That's why I quit teaching at community college.
I don't know, man. I mean, I'm just, you know, I just can't, this, it's to me, what Spicer says in that thing is better than I've heard anyone else say about on politics and poetry. I can't, and I think he's right. And man, not that he didn't write some kind of political things at the time, but I think that's the key, right? When you can write about things that, but you're writing about them as a person where those things are affecting you, not as someone trying to change somebody's mind.
Sure.
Like you mentioned Amiri Baraka earlier, and some of his stuff is great, but his best poems that have political content to me, yeah, they've got political content in them, but he's not trying to convince anybody of anything.
He isn't. No.
That's him as a person wrestling with those things. And like, it's not heavy-handed in any sort of way. It's just, this is something he's thinking about.
It's honest, yeah. And it risks being embarrassing because yeah. He's struggling with it, and he's taking us on this ride of his own struggle as a universal struggle. I don't think anything that we've read necessarily.
Maybe that first one.
Maybe the first one. I thought about that one too.
Like, that borders on that. Oh, she's trying to do that at least.
Sure.
It a little bit doesn't work, but
in that way,
she's trying to do that. I mean, I have to respect that on some level. Like, she's trying to actually wrestle with things she's thinking about and did make it simple, right? I mean, we didn't know that. We didn't know she was black, but here she is, a black woman, and she's even being critical of the way she feels like her people are talking about things on some level. She's really wrestling with that.
Yeah.
Like, she's thinking about it, right? Like, she's playing with that idea. She's not worried about how someone's going to take that. Maybe that, I mean, I think that's the closest thing of any of those things we read that's trying to do that.
Sure. Yeah. It's not delving into pop culture, getting lost in this sort of, like, you know, referential thing. It's not, you know, I'm trying to think of the other ones that we read. It's not, you know, it's not kind of wallowing in this sort of, like, you know, armchair. Well, it's like the armchair is mad at the armchair.
Oh, we didn't read this one.
What's this one? I don't know. That one seems
kind of funny. We're not going to read it because it's too long. But this is kind of funny. This was also in that anthology. But this is C.A. Conrad. And
lovely guy.
I think it's very funny. It's like it's him writing this because that was from 2008. Right? Him writing to George W. Bush.
Oh, that's right. I think I remember.
And it's kind of good, but this, again, it's one of those ones where it's like, this is as much as it has a political topic, is not political at all because it's basically him, as much as he hates George W. Bush, becoming empathetic with him the more he writes the poem. Which is beautiful. And I mean, that's a beautiful thing, right? Like, the more he writes the poem, he's like, yeah, I don't like what you're doing, but he just kind of becomes more and more empathetic with him through the course of the poem. Kind of feels sorry for him. Feels sorry.
Wow.
You know, which, I mean, okay, that's real, right? Like, that's like, he maybe set out to write a political poem. He probably set out writing that with some direction he wanted to go in, but he let the poem go where it wanted to go. and he let it be something that on some level someone might think is ineffective. It's certainly not communicating probably the point he wanted when he started, but it's a much better poem.
This is kind of sweet. Yeah, this is, yeah. I like this. I like the process of this is, "Dear Mr. President, there was eggshell under your desk last night in my dream." Like, how nice, how sweet. How sweet of CA to just come through and sort of address this. But, you know, even that title is like, it has this like intense empathy.
Yeah.
In a way that's like specifically addressing the president on like such a personal level.
Yeah.
There's a political act there. It's like well, making
that is, but that's a real political act.
It's a real political act.
It's not trying to hit someone over the head with something.
No.
It's like actually being, I'm gonna just be a person, no matter what. Even this person I don't like. I'm going to just be a person about it. Well, I'm going to deal with them as a person. I'm not going to deal with them as a cardboard cutout of something that I think they stand for.
It's also this sort of like friendly, sweet warning. Like, there's eggshell under your desk last night in my dream.
There's still some contempt behind it, which is...
Of course.
Which is great, but it's also a contempt that you have for a person, not for some prop. Which is, I think, what happens with a lot of these is things just become props, right?
I mean, we get down here in the bottom of the, you know, the bottom of this thing is like, oh, hey, I'm serious about this. Let's go away together this spring, just the two of us. It's not a big deal. Don't even tell anyone. I mean, you're the president after all, but there's a marvelous stretch of woods where I grew up. We could smoke a little pot to wind down and get you out of your Oval Office mode, maybe a little wine. I'm sure you need a good massage. Maybe we could go to the creek and paint secret mud symbols on our naked bodies like I used to with my first boyfriend. What happens after that? We'll be fine, you'll see. It'll be okay. And break in the woods has the best flowers to rest beside in the sun, and you will awaken with the crown of honeysuckle. Beautiful man that you are, a real leader of real lives who can change the world with real love waiting for you. See you, Conrad.
But it's like...
That's so...
But it's not sarcastic. Like, he's serious.
No, he's serious. Like, well, and see,
that,
okay,
yeah,
so this...
That's knowing CA, but...
But I think CA like, gets the closest here... In what I charged us with at the beginning of the podcast, he actually co-ops the language.
Yeah.
He co-ops the language of a love letter.
Yeah. Well,
and he addresses the president.
It's super Frank O'Hara, right? Like, this is a Frank O'Hara imitation
poem. Oh, for sure.
But he does it in a way that's awesome, and it's still his own poem. Like, it's
of course.
It's not like a straight up, but yeah. And it's funny to do a Frank O'Hara poem to someone you hate, which... I can't think of a situation, or maybe not hate. Maybe hate is the wrong word, but someone that you so strongly disagree with. All of Frank O'Hara's letter poems are to people that he loves in some way.
Sure.
And that's part of why the poem works, because he's doing this to someone that he strongly disagrees with and dislikes, but he's still trying to like project that love to them. And
I like that because I mean, just a little snippet here that we read here. I like that because what it does is he uses the language to debase to like not maybe that debase
sort of,
might be
like,
the strong word, but more like take the power away. CA commands the power because he's addressing the. He's addressing Bush as a real person, as a potential love.
It's funny, right? Because you start reading it and you feel like, oh, he's making fun of him, but then you're like, oh no, he's not making fun of him.
No,
he's just like, I'm gonna be
your buddy,
the more loving person.
I'm gonna be the more loving person.
And I'm gonna find that, like you were saying about the patriarch. I'm gonna find the beauty behind that. All those sinister, ugly things. There's still some beauty underneath there, and I'm gonna find it. Right?
Yeah.
It's
just a letter.
Maybe the job
did he send
of poetry
it?
To do. Right? I wonder. Yeah, that'd be funny if he sent it to him. I'm sure even if he did, he never read it. But that's. I don't know. That's a good. I kind of like that one.
That's
And it's
what a political move to like address, you know, like that's the thing is like everybody. I think the easy thing, like right now with our current administration, it's so easy to make fun of the things and to poke fun of the same. We go back to the same things, and we're addressing sort of this like, you know, demagogue, you know, like egotist entity here, but maybe it's like, maybe what the thing needs to happen is like, just like, just like our current administrator, chief administrator, is debasing all the other, like taking the power away from other things. Maybe it's time. Maybe what needs to happen is people need to go in and take the power away from him by finding some beauty.
Well, I think there's a lot of ways to do it, and I think poetry's job is finding the beauty in things a lot of the time. But I think whatever tack you take, for poetry, meeting things head on is always the wrong. Whatever tack you take, it's got to be something under the surface, right? Like he's not directly confronting George W. here.
No.
He's doing it in an indirect way, right? And I think that's the power of poetry, if it has any, right, is it's able to do things in an indirect way that are stronger than most things are able to do in a direct way. Poetry is not about directness. Poetry is the opposite of directness, right? In a lot of ways, right? You don't... The ability of poetry is to be able to express things indirectly that are otherwise inexpressible. Like, if you were able to express it directly, then you would choose probably any of 50 other mediums other than poetry, right? Like, poetry is not for that. That'd be like if you're trying to, like, you know, write a legal document through music. That doesn't make any sense.
True.
Like,
well,
you know, but what it might be interesting as figuring out the difference between those two things, right? But if you were like, I'm trying to, like, you know, sue my landlord, I'm gonna do it through a piece of music, that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, right? Like, and I think that's something people lose sight of with poetry. Like, don't try to convince me of something through poetry, because that's not the medium for it, right?
Sure.
Like, if you're trying to convince me of something, that's great, but do it some other way than poetry. If you're writing poetry, be aware of what your medium does and use it for that purpose. Don't try to make it do something that it's not suited to.
So you think the poetry has jumped the shark? You think poetry is like, you know, has like...
I mean, I think some people, yeah, I think that's the problem, right? But it's also because, like you were talking about, part of the reason is because that has a broader appeal.
It does, because it's because...
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, even slam is like the whole slam scene is like it goes in its political direction a lot of times, but it's really entertainment. It's entertainment, you know. And then it tries to be this political thing, and people are motivated and moved by it, and it's okay. Like,
but it's preaching to the choir.
Is it an agency
really
of change?
Like, no one who disagreed with what that. I mean, there's exceptions. There are good slam poets. I'm not going to say all of them are bad, right? There are some who are good.
Of course.
But they're the minority. But for the majority of slam poetry that is dealing with political subjects, no one who didn't agree with it before you spoke your first word is going to agree with you after you're done. Right?
Of course not. Because...
So then what is the point, right? Like... So really the point is
to rally?
Really the point is to get a bunch of people who already agree with you to clap because they agree with you.
That's pretty much the tenor of most poetry readings. I mean, you know, you bring all your friends out so they clap at your bad poetry or at your poetry. I don't know, bad.
I mean...
This is the No Good Poetry podcast, so we can...
Unfortunately,
you know.
I think that is often the case, but that is not how poetry was when I grew to love it, and I don't think that's how it was when you grew to love it. But maybe, I mean, even at that time, that was probably not the mainstream of poetry, I guess. But that's the beautiful part.
Yeah, you know, I'm so still in love with the avant-garde, and I think maybe some of the reasons that I think that I'm so in love with the avant-garde, especially Dadaism and especially Surrealism, and well, Futurism has its own problems to it as well, but is that, like, what those guys and girls were doing in Zurich in 1916 was extremely political.
Yeah.
They were co-opting the language. They were taking things and turning them on their side and
weird,
representing
right?
them in a
wasn't
new way.
Political That's what's interesting, because it wasn't political against a particular regime. It was political against all of society.
Yeah. Right? Well, it got...
Which is like...
Once it hit Berlin, it became... It was extreme. It was a political machine at that point. But, you know, in a literary sort of sense...
It was kind of against all society. It was kind of like... Yeah, sometimes that was used against particular regimes, but it was also like, the problem is all of these regimes in all of these countries suck. And all of it, the problem is we need to wake everybody up.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we don't want you to just replace this with some other slightly better version of the same thing. We want you to rethink how you're looking at the whole
rethink
world,
everything. Right? Rethink advertising. Rethink language from the ground up. You know, and they were like, Zurich...
We're going to have to do a Dada episode.
Well, of course.
Surrealism episode.
Of course.
But that's in the future. But I don't know. I mean, I think that that was an interesting thing about... Oh, one postscript here, looking at the Weather Underground, that was much later, man.
That was in the 70s?
70s, yeah.
Okay.
So, Spicer was even further ahead with that. But I'm just going to say, you know, since we're talking about politics and poetry... And, you know, this is a time where a lot of people are trying to, in whatever area they're looking at, trying to think about how they can make political change. And, man, I don't have the answer to that. I'm probably more pessimistic like Spicer is. But I'm going to tell you right now, if you're one of those people trying to do that, please, please, please think about what you're doing. Don't just do something because it's... along with what you believe. Think about what effect do you want to have happen and how are you going to make that happen, right? Like,
I think Spicer's advice was the same thing, was the same advice that Baraka gave to me and Brian Boyles when we interviewed him at Xavier when he came and spoke. And we asked him, we said, what do we do? Like, what are we supposed to do? And he says, you have to go into your community, your specific community, and you have to look around you, and you have to see what they need. And if you're not seeing what your community needs, and it could be a small community, it could be a bigger community, and maybe sometimes there's big fish in small ponds, and maybe small ponds and small fish in big ponds. You know, you got to know your community.
But the effects you're going to make dealing with the people you're interacting with directly are going to have a much more immense effect than... a protest, I hate to say, man. And I'm not saying that there's not possible to have good protests. I think it is, but it's very difficult. And the majority of the time, it's not that effective. And you got to think about how you're spending your time. And I'd much rather see someone spending every day of their life affecting people on a small level. And I think that's going to make a bigger impact. If everyone was doing that, we wouldn't have this problem in the first place. No one could be believing all the bullshit they believe if they actually had people challenging them every day. Don't be a coward. Like, challenge people. Challenge the people in your life on the things that they believe and the things that they think. Make them think about things and don't be worried if they're going to be pissed off at you.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, the power of poetry needs to be... wielded, and I don't know where we're at. It's like such a confusing thing, but that's why we're investigating. That's what we're talking about, is like, you know, what power does it still wield, and can it wield, you know, any major thing? And if we're still engaged in this, in the tropes and the formulas of the academy and of the scene and of the 3 minutes and 15 seconds that we have to fit our language into, you know, can it have any power again? And it's like, it seems as though, like, it's, you know, it's been co-opted again and again and again and again, and we have to figure out how to, you know, readdress it. And I think that the way to do that is to, like, actually get down to the base of the language itself that we're using. Like, every sort of phrase and punctuation and sentence and line and formula and equation and all of it, and how the language works and how the rhymes work and how the rhymes don't work and how the language doesn't work. It's like the most intense thing that we could do right now is to fully examine it and figure out how to use it in a way that's is like it can do a thing. I don't know.
Yeah, but every poem that has ever affected me, I'm not going to speak for you, but I have a feeling you're going to agree with me. Every poem that has ever affected me, on some level, I came away from that and I said, holy shit, I didn't know you could do that. right?
Any poem that's blown you away any way.
In any way, and there's different ways that you can do that. But man, you know, if you're just doing something that you're like, this is well-formed, but it's similar to something I've seen before, man, I'm not going to come away from that. I might come away being like, that was good. But that's the most I'm going to come away from that with. Any poem that's ever been moving to me, and that's all kinds of ways. Sometimes it is language. A lot of times it is language. But sometimes, like, that is something I never thought of before. Sometimes it's just being adventurous in your thought. But a lot of times language leads you to that. Language leads you to things you would have never thought of, right? If you let the language take you where it's going to take you, right? But I mean, I don't know. Like, that's the important part, right? Like, let's stop repeating the same shit over and over again, whether it's in poetry or whether it's in everyday life. Like, that's a waste of time. I don't need to hear the same shit I've heard over and over again. I want to hear the stuff that I haven't heard before.
True. Yeah, and you know, like all these, all, I mean, it's like, and all the social media, and all that, it's like, it's all formula.
It's all made to repeat things.
It's all made to be in a formula. It's all made to let us make us fit into a box with a certain colors, a certain text, in a certain way. And there's like a control factor, and there's a constraint factor. And, you know, that in and of itself is like, almost, it almost doesn't matter what you put in that box and what you write in that input device. It's like, you know, you format your feed, and so your feed is what you get, and that's what you get, and that's what you want, because that's what you want to read. And, you know, it's
but it's about conformity, right, when it really comes down to it. And it's about in the long run, look, we went through this whole thing. That's funny, right? Like, you know, we went through this whole thing in the 60s and 70s about being a rebel being a cool thing, and then advertising co-opted being a rebel. So now we're back to being... now we're back to not being a rebel is okay again, right? And I don't care, man. You don't need to be a rebel. But just, you know... just do something interesting.
Well, do something that breaks language open, you know, do something that really cracks it open, and something that's a little dangerous. You know, it's like there's like the scale of safe and what's safe decisions and what's dangerous decisions. And, you know, I think a lot of times people err toward the safety, even with their poems, especially with their poems, you know?
I think that's a lot of it. I think we probably over-talked where we really were here, but that was a good discussion.
Be a little dangerous with your work. Be a little political.
Yeah.
Be a little dangerous. How can you be dangerous?
Be something dangerous. Don't try to be. Just, I mean, I think, you know, I think I like that from Spicer, although he is a little crazy. He thought Martians were communicating it to him or whatever. But I do believe in that part. Like, he does say that he feels like he's a conduit for it, not... it doesn't have to do with your ego. It's an egoless thing, writing poetry in a way, right? Like, it has to be about confronting the fact that your ego is fake, right?
And sure.
Being a medium for something coming through, right?
Sure.
One way or the other. It doesn't have to be. You don't have to believe in ghosts. You don't have to believe in reincarnation or any of that thing. Whatever your explanation for it is, though, you can still be a... whether it's just yourself as your subconscious, that's still not you.
He seemed kind of tapped into the crown chakra. You know, he seemed tapped into, like, this receiving thing and, like, being a conduit rather than, like, this, like... Ginsberg was more like the third eye kind of thing,
and
the
do that, right?
Good Pound poets. Was so throat chakra, like they're so like.
I don't know, man, but I think all of them were doing that on some level. Like you can say that about Ginsberg, but I think that's Ginsberg's worst stuff where he's being like that. I think his best stuff, he's doing the same thing, man. What is Hal if it's not prophetic, and what is a prophet
true.
If you're not letting someone speak through you rather than speaking for yourself, right?
Maybe we should leave it right there.
All right. We'll see y'all next
time. This has been the No Good Poetry Podcast from Joseph Makos and...
Joseph Biano. Oh, I didn't know what you were doing there. That's all right.